Today, relax, the crisis is over. The DFA Daily to the 6th of June 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics Workplaces Post, covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. In today's digest, we look at the latest on US jobs and markets, more on Australian home prices, and some further thoughts on the government's renovation scheme. But before I start, a quick reminder, my guest on DFA's live Q&A stream, which is on Tuesday at 8 p.m. Sydney time, will be Tony Lecantro from Alto Capital. As an investment manager, Tony's view of the market should prove interesting, to say nothing of his wider views on the economy. You can ask a question live on the YouTube chat, or send them beforehand via the DFA blog. Links are below. Wall Street surged on Friday, and the Nasdaq was on course to set a new record, closing high after the May jobs provided an astonishing upside surprise, and the clearest evidence yet that the US economy is bouncing back sooner than many expected from pandemic-related lockdowns. The Nasdaq is set to be the first among the three major US stock indices to claim all-time highs that they reached back in February. And the S&P 500 and the Dow are now within 6% and 8% overtaking their record closing levels. And the benchmark S&P 500 is now within 1% of showing a year-to-date gain. The US economy added a remarkable 2.5 million jobs last month, rebounding from April's record 20.7 million payrolls drop and pushing the unemployment rate down to 13.3%. The report jarred with separate data released a day earlier by the Labour Department, which said it received weekly unemployment claims for the first time from 1.9 million Australians, bringing to nearly 43 million the number receiving jobless insurance since the COVID-19 hit in March. But analysts had expected to see unemployment soaring to a historic 19.8%, so the 13.3% number is being interpreted as confirming the pandemic's impacts were temporary, and that when the economy reopened and the infection rates started to diminish, those jobs would come back. As The Hill put it, the new figure is much better than expected, yet still much worse than the nadir of the Great Recession more than a decade ago. The complicated dynamic poses challenges for both President Trump and for his presumptive Democratic challenger, former Vice President Joe Biden. Trump has already begun celebrating the job numbers, but in doing so, he could end up sounding a note that appears too euphoric and therefore out of step with the millions who have been thrown into unemployment in recent months. And the reverse is true for Biden. He argued on Friday that missteps by Trump in handling the coronavirus crisis had deepened its economic impact, and that the president is prematurely declaring victory. But if he goes too far in that direction, Biden leaves himself open to the charge that he is talking down a recovery or even rooting for continued economic suffering as a tool that would help lever Trump out of the White House in November. Even some Democrats are expressing concerns about whether their party's response to the unexpected economic news will strike the right tone. And by the way, Biden has now just clinched the Democratic presidential nomination, officially setting the stage for a contentious general election fight with President Trump this November. US Treasury yields rose on the jobs data, giving a boost to interest rate sensitive banks and sending the S&P Banks Index up by 5.5%. Indeed, as Wall Street pointed out, the 30-year Treasury yield has been rising for a week now, closing on Thursday at 1.61%, up from 1.41% on May the 29th, and up from 1.17% on April the 20th. And that's the highest since March the 19th, when the Fed was unleashing its multi-trillion dollar everything bubble bailout. The 20-year yield closed at 1.38%, the highest since March the 4th, and the 10-year yield closed at 0.82%, the highest since March the 26th. Obviously, these yields are still in the financial repression torture basement, but the rises are showing some impatience in the market, he said. The short-term yields are just a hair above zero, with one-month yields at 0.13%, which makes for a curiously steep yield curve. The red line shows Treasury yields at the close from the one-year yield to the 30-year yield. The blue line shows the yields on March the 2nd before the desperate rate cuts and bailouts, and the green line shows the yields last November the 5th. When a yield curve steepens, it's sometimes associated with the reaction in the markets to a strong economy, and that would be a good thing. But this is the worst economy in our lifetimes, and any improvement there will be some eventually, will just make the economy a little less terrible. Rather than seeing a strengthening economy, markets might be worrying more about inflation, given all this money printing in combination with trillions of dollars in government stimulus spending, even as the economy is in terrible shape. Stagflation of the 1970s was a condition where the economy was in decent shape compared to today's economy, but just wasn't growing much, while inflation was ballooning. Today's economy is an unspeakable fiasco, and a big bout of inflation that would eviscerate the purchasing power of labour for the lucky ones that still have jobs would create a phenomenon far worse than stagflation. But hey, the markets aren't concerned, at least for now. Just remember that the Fed balance sheet went up by another 1% this past week, or $67.9 billion, to a new high of $7.16 trillion. And since September 2019, when the financial crisis exploded, they have lifted their balance sheet by 80.2%, or $3.4 trillion. More helicopter money for Wall Street. Oh, and airlines, among the hardest hit by the coronavirus crisis, soared, with the ARCA Airlines Index jumping 8.5%. But the World Health Organization warned that the COVID-19 pandemic, which brought the global economy to its knees in the wake of mandated shutdowns, is far from over, and new cases indeed are on the rise. And Fitch Ratings said macro policy easing responses to the coronavirus crisis have reached unprecedented levels, with direct fiscal stimulus measures totaling $5 trillion, which is 7% of 2019 global GDP, for the Fitch 20 countries covered in its Global Economic Outlook, the GEO. The scale of fiscal easing announced to date, which could increase further, is significantly larger than the fiscal response seen after the global financial crisis, when the advanced economies saw a fiscal easing of around 3-4% of GDP. Massive policy easing will undoubtedly help the pace of the post-crisis economic recovery, said Fitch. Central bank responses have been similarly impressive, with new quantitative easing asset purchases expected to reach 20% of GDP in the US, 9% in the UK and Canada, and more than 7% in the Eurozone, and a wide array of new credit facilities. The ECB could also further increase its bond buying program. Responses to the crisis have, however, been strikingly uneven, with developed market countries within the Fitch 20 set to spend an aggressive $7.6 trillion US, which is 11% of 2019 GDP, in overall fiscal support measures, including guarantees and quasi-fiscal measures, while emerging market economies have announced a modest $1.2 trillion, which is 1.8% of 2019 GDP. Responses vary from direct fiscal support to households and businesses to government-granted fiscal guarantees or quasi-fiscal measures borne by public agencies. Various central banks have adopted monetary easing, asset purchase programs, and the launching of new liquidity or refinancing facilities to support the real economy, including via the banking sector. The speed and size of macro policy easing will influence both the intensity of the immediate coronavirus-related macro shock and the pace of the post-crisis economic recovery. Using a broad definition of fiscal support, including direct fiscal easing measures and guarantees, Germany, Italy, and the UK each have announced more than 20% of GDP overall fiscal support, followed closely by France at 17.5%. For the largest four Eurozone countries, as well as for the UK, more than 70% of the total fiscal response is composed of government guarantees. Direct fiscal measures in Europe vary from around 3% in Spain and Poland to 4.5% in France and Italy, 5.5% in the UK and 8% in Germany. And the European Commission has proposed a €750 billion joint fiscal package, which is 6.3% of Eurozone GDP, to finance the recovery. But this has yet to be agreed at the EU member state level, and therefore it may not be certain. And the US also announced an enormous stimulus package and established a wide range of support instruments. Direct fiscal easing exceeds that announced so far in Europe at 11.5% of GDP, although the scale of new federal fiscal guarantees has been smaller at 2.4% of GDP. Similarly, Japan has announced a large support package, and Fitch estimates that actual new discretionary measures, guarantees, and quasi-fiscal measures adopted by the government will account for, wait for it, 32.3% of GDP. Central banks in developed countries have also unleashed a salvo of monetary and credit stimulus. The Federal Reserve has deployed the largest monetary apparatus of all developed market countries, with a pledge of unlimited asset purchases and the creation of 14 new liquidity facilities to support the real economy and the banking sector. And they expect new QE purchases of government bonds and mortgage-backed securities to exceed $4 trillion in 2020. In the Eurozone, they also announced more purchases, and for the first time, Canada and Australia too. The Bank of Japan has also increased the frequency of government bond purchases and has extended targeted purchases of corporate bonds, commercial papers, and exchange-traded funds. Central banks have also launched new extensive credit facilities to support the real economy and the financial sector, ranging from 5% of GDP in Australia to about 10% in Japan and the US, and almost 13% in Canada. In emerging markets, the policy response has been more restrained in most countries, with the exception of Brazil, Poland, and South Africa, which has adopted large fiscal packages in response to the pandemic, 7% of GDP in South Africa, 9% in Poland, and 16.6% in Brazil. And new discretionary fiscal measures and new refinancing and liquidity facilities account for less than 2% of GDP in Mexico and India, while the Russian response appears modest, given the country's fiscal flexibility relative to its EM peers. China's fiscal response has been more muted than other large economies at around 5% of GDP, and credit easing has been far smaller than in 2009. One common feature of the EM policy response to the crisis was widespread interest rate cuts despite large currency shocks across the board, with sharp cuts in Turkey, South Africa, Mexico, Brazil, and India. And several EM central banks have also initiated bond buying programs, although the scale of asset purchase is limited and the focus is on market stabilization rather than boosting lending. And market participants now turn their focus to the US Federal Reserve, at whose monetary policy meeting next week the latest jobs data will almost certainly be discussed. And for the record, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 3.39% to 27,173. The S&P 500 gained 2.81% to 3,199. And the NASDAQ Composite added 2.16% to 9,823. Gold futures fell nearly 3% on Friday, falling off their $1,700 perch to 1,680. Gold traders rushed for the exit after they were stunned by the robust non-farm payroll report, said Ed Meyer, analyst at New York's Uwanda. It will be hard for the Fed to remain extremely accommodative if the world's largest economy is already in recovery mode. Yet, he concluded that gold might not get much more support from the Fed, but geopolitical risks, second wave concerns, and an eventually weaker US dollar should keep the longer term bullish outlook intact for gold. Bitcoin went above $10,000 US this week before settling back to around $9,600. But Bloomberg seems to have joined the long list of entities that are now quite bullish on Bitcoin. According to a Bloomberg Crypto Outlook publication, the number one coin could hit $20,000 before the end of the year. One of the reasons for Bloomberg's predictions is that Bitcoin is maturing quite impressively. It compared Bitcoin's maturity rate to that of other assets such as shares in the traditional stock market and other assets like oil. The publication also talks about Bitcoin's adoption and how there's been a significant increase in the number of active addresses. This veritably points to the fact that a lot more people are now using Bitcoin, adding to its rapid maturity. All 11 major segments of the S&P 500 were in the black, with energy, financials, and industrials leading the gainers in a continuation of a rotation into cyclicals, which were beaten up amid economic lockdowns. Small caps and transportation stocks also outperformed, with the Russell 2000 and the Dow Transportation up 4.7% and 3.9% respectively. Hi, it's Liz Interruption, but if you're getting value from this post and have not done so, please consider subscribing to this channel or ring the bell for custom alerts. Plus, please consider supporting our efforts. You can make a one-off donation via PayPal, here's the link, or subscribe via Patreon for as little as $3 US a month or more to get access to exclusive additional content. Alternatively, you can also donate using Bitcoin. Here is the QR code. The links are in the comments below. I really appreciate your support, which enables us to continue to make more great content. Thanks very much. Now, back to the current show. Back in Australia, the ASX was up on Friday too, with the ASX 200 gaining 0.12% to hit a new one-month high. And AMP's Shane Oliver has revised his property price predictions. His base case was a recession that saw unemployment rise to around 7.5%, and that would push average home prices down around 5%. But the risk was that a deeper downturn with, say, 10% unemployment could see a 20% fall in prices, he said. But now, he says, subsequent government support measures, along with an earlier reopening of the economy, have reduced the risks of worst-case scenarios for home prices. The combination of the need for social distancing and the banning for a while of traditional on-site auctions led to a sharp decline in properties for sale. In addition to this, the federal government's JobKeeper scheme, keeping around 3.5 million people in paid employment and a doubling in unemployment benefits along with bank mortgage payment holidays, all of which are for 6 months to September, have helped head off an increase in forced sales that might have occurred given the size of the hit to the economy. So while property demand has fallen, it's been matched by a collapse in supply, which has left the property market in a bit of a twilight zone, he says. While listings have started to pick up a bit lately, they are still very low, and this has all helped soften the blow to house prices that would have otherwise occurred, but prices are indeed still starting to fall. According to CoreLogic, after slowing to just 0.2% growth in April, average capital city home prices fell 0.5% in May. Prices fell in all cities except Adelaide, Hobart and Canberra, with Melbourne down 0.9%, Sydney down 0.4% and Perth down 0.6%. This has seen the monthly change in capital city home prices collapse from a peak of 2% in November. There are basically, he said, five positives for property prices. Firstly, mortgage rates have fallen to record lows with deals around 2 to 3%. This is keeping mortgage debt interest costs as a share of household income well below historic highs, even though the ratio of household debt to income is at a record high of around 200%. Low mortgage costs are all making the funding costs for an investment property very low, he said. And then government support measures have provided a huge boost to household income, supported businesses, supported employment to around 3.5 million workers, prevented a confidence zapping surge in measured unemployment, and with mortgage payment holidays, which have seen around 440,000 mortgage deferrals, are preventing a sharp rise in mortgage delinquencies and hence false sales. And the shutdown, impacting mostly service jobs, has hit women and younger workers harder in contrast to past recessions, which have hit male breadwinners harder. And this may have also helped keep down debt servicing problems, he said. And he makes the point that China is running 2 to 3 months ahead of Australia with respect to the coronavirus shock, and his experience provides some guide. While property sales were near zero in the peak lockdown month of February, average property price growth slowed but did not go negative and is now picking up a bit. Against these positives, though, there are some big negatives for property prices flowing from the coronavirus shock. High unemployment, he said, is where you have to start. He has long regarded the combination of high home prices and high household debt as Australia's Achilles heel, and so he feared back in March that a large rise in unemployment would trigger debt servicing problems for sales, and so sharp falls in prices. As it's turned out, though, he said, measured unemployment is being suppressed and household incomes supported by stimulus measures. This is by design to help businesses, jobs and incomes hold up through the shutdown period. It's likely headed off the worst case 20% decline in house price scenarios. But once the support measures end later this year, measured unemployment will likely rise to around 8% and take a long time to fall back to pre-coronavirus levels of around 5.2%. This, in turn, is likely to lead to some increase in mortgage defaults as bank payment holidays for around 440,000 mortgages end, boosting forced sales and act as a drag on property demand. Albeit, it's unlikely to be anywhere near what would have occurred in the absence of support measures through the shutdown. And he also points to a big drop in immigration. Thanks to travel bans, the government expects net immigration to fall to just below 170,000 this financial year and to be around 35,000 next financial year from 240,000 last financial year. This is a huge hit, and if it occurs, the government would always allow a faster return of immigration if they could. It will take population growth over 2021 to just 0.7%, its lowest since 1917. It will imply a hit of underlying dwelling demand of around 80,000 dwellings over the next 12 months, taking it down to around 120,000, compared to underlying demand last year of around 200,000. This risks resulting in a significant oversupply of dwellings, reversing years of undersupply that has maintained very high home prices since mid-last decade. A cut to immigration is not something China has had to deal with, so its property market experience is not directly translatable to Australia on this point. Falling rents and rising vacancy rates also are having an impact. Vacancy rates rose sharply in April, and this plus rent relief is putting downward pressure on rents. This will be further impacted by very low immigration. It will further weigh on investor demand and may cause problems for heavily geared property investors. And measures to boost housing construction, of course, are also impacting. Faced with a big reduction in housing construction activity over the year ahead, governments appear to be working on plans to boost activity to protect home builders' jobs via new home building grants and possibly the construction of social housing. Normally, first home buyer grants provide a boost in overall demand, but if the focus is just on boosting supply at a time when underlying demand is very low, reflecting lower immigration, it could add to downward pressure on average prices. And proposed moves from stamp duty to land tax in some states could provide a short-term boost to home prices, but it should be long-term neutral if the same revenue is raised, and it's unclear whether or when it will occur. So his worst-case scenario for a 20% decline in prices and those of others seeing 30% plus falls, he says, are unlikely thanks to support measures and to the earlier reopening of the economy. To get those worst-case scenarios would require a second wave of coronavirus cases and so a renewed shutdown or other leg down in the economy in response to a surge in bankruptcies. However, further falls in prices are still likely, as true unemployment, to become clear after September, remains high for several years. Government support measures and the bank payment holiday ends after September. Immigration falls, and likely government measures boost housing construction. So his base case is for a national average price to fall between 5 and 10% in the next year, with Sydney and Melbourne likely to see 10% falls as they are more exposed to immigration and have higher debt levels, whereas Adelaide, Brisbane, Perth and Hobart are only likely to see small falls and Canberra prices are likely to be flat, he said. Now, this may be seen as a reasonable outcome, he says, in terms of making housing more affordable, but without posing a big threat to the economy via a downward spiral of falling prices and negative wealth effects on consumer spending at the same time. And finally, from the conversation, the federal government's new $688 million home builder package might protect residential construction jobs, but it's a missed opportunity, they say, to deliver sustainable benefits that would save owners money in the long run. The $25,000 grant for new homes and renovations could have been better leveraged to provide broader and ongoing benefits. It could have been used to ensure homes are more energy efficient and cheaper to run. The grant is available for building an owner-occupied home with property values, house and land, under $750,000 and renovations costing between $150,000 and $750,000 for a proposed property valued under $1.5 million, which are under $1.5 million are also eligible. Grants are means tested against household incomes. The scheme could have required new houses to exceed minimum building code requirements to be eligible. The development industry would have then had to deliver housing to this standard or risk losing potential buyers. Using the right design and materials would mean any extra costs are recouped over time. Heating and cooling energy use could be reduced by almost 25% across capital city climate zones with minimal requirements. New houses could achieve these reductions with a solar PV system and a 7-star performance rating in line with proposed changes to raise the National Construction Code's current 6-star minimum in 2022. This would reduce utility bills and carbon footprints for householders, and the use of majority Australian-made materials could be stipulated. Local renewable energy insulation and energy-efficient businesses would benefit from increased demand. Job creation would follow in these and secondary industries. The $25,000 grant cost to government would more than cover the costs of these requirements. And various Australian studies have found achieving a 7-star rating involves little, if any, extra cost for new houses in many locations. And the costs of solar PV continues to fall. Combining these sustainability measures through Home Builder would provide benefits across the lifetime of new houses. Restricting Home Builder grants to renovation projects over $150,000 excludes many modest renovations like upgrading a kitchen or bathroom, and it is already being called a handout for the rich. Much of the existing housing stock in Australia has poor energy and thermal performance, and many houses are too hot in summer or too cold in winter, or both. A better and more equitable strategy would be to provide renovation grants for energy-efficient retrofits in owner-occupied and rental housing. And retrofits could be undertaken for a fraction of the price of the renovation grant and still help a range of trades. And there would be demand for heating and cooling systems, insulation and draft proofing to be supplied and installed. Households would save on bills and suffer less from extreme temperatures. Energy efficiency retrofits are a cost-effective way to improve environmental performance, thermal comfort, health, and well-being. Much of Australia's existing housing stock could be upgraded to 5 stars for much less than the budgets required by the announced stimulus, and retrofits should be determined by an in-house sustainability assessment by qualified assessors, another potential growth area. Programs like the Victorian Residential Energy Scorecard already offer guidance on best practice. Identifying the best retrofitting opportunities for individual properties would ensure each household gets best value for money. And the need to upskill tradies and limitations of local manufacturing are often cited as barriers to improve the sustainability of Australian housing. HomeBuilder could offer incentives to overcome these obstacles, setting higher building performance standards as a condition of the HomeBuilder grant would upskill workers and create jobs. And tradies would have the opportunity to work on tens of thousands of houses with higher performance ratings. And this would provide extensive professional experience of building more sustainable housing across the country. Local manufacturing and secondary industries could innovate and supply sustainable building materials and technologies for Australian conditions. Improving housing sustainability would also help achieve broader federal and state government policy goals. For a start, it would help Australia achieve targets for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. It would also help with issues such as energy vulnerability and security. And as a final note, economists, housing researchers, and social housing organisations all argue that a program designed to deliver more social housing would provide greater benefits Australia certainly needs to increase its social housing stock, and home building could have helped with that. If future stimulus schemes target social housing, we suggest environmental and energy performance should be top priorities from the outset, they said. And I think that is a good summary. But I'd also make the point that I'm sure the banks will be willing to offer up to $150,000 improvement loans to allow access to the home builder grants. So what's a little more debt between friends? I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.